This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Can Washington politics be reformed? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A Washington firm has shut down its lobbying operation due to press reports about its ties to Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff. DeLay is no longer a leader of Congress. Abramoff is talking to the FBI. But House Speaker Dennis Hastert still is promising major reform. On To the Point, has the growth of government, combined with human nature, made corruption inevitable? Reformers say it's time to abandon that cynical view and get on with the job of cleaning up Capitol Hill. We'll hear what's being proposed. On Reporter's Notebook later on, will Katrina victims be kicked out of New Orleans hotels in time for Mardi Gras? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Reports about Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff have undermined public confidence in elected officials. On To the Point, we'll hear about reforms being proposed on Capitol Hill. Can they be effective? Or has big government made political corruption inevitable? On Reporter's Notebook, FEMA says the money is running out for Katrina victims in New Orleans hotels who are booking guests for Mardi Gras. We'll hear what's next. First, this news update. As promised, Iran today removed the seals on uranium enrichment equipment and resumed the research the U.S. and other countries say could lead to development of nuclear weapons. Inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency were present as Iranian officials declared once again their goal is only production of nuclear power. Jim Walsh is executive director at Harvard's Project on Managing the Atom. Jim Walsh, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
There appears to be no direct evidence of weapons research. What is it that makes the U.S. and the European Union so suspicious?
Well, I'd say the main issue that makes them concerned is a track record of concealment and deception. The U.S. has long suspected that Iran might have nuclear ambitions, and even going back to the Shah, when the Shah of Iran was a friend of the U.S., there were concerns that the Shah was pursuing nuclear weapons. But what really is of more immediate concern is that for the past 20 years, Iran has procured nuclear technology on the black market and has run its nuclear program in the dark and hasn't been transparent as it's obliged to be under its safeguards and under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
What exactly have they done today by removing the seals and saying they're going to continue their research? What does that mean?
Well, it has more political meaning than anything else. Remember that what Iran had previously done was, quote, voluntarily suspended, unquote, its work on enrichment. It wasn't required to stop its work on enrichment, and it's Iran's position that under the treaty, it's fully entitled to work on enrichment and reprocessing programs. After all, other treaty members are allowed to do that. Japan, the United States, Germany, Brazil wants to get into the enrichment game. And so their complaint is, why are you singling us out? We should be allowed to do what others are doing. We are a member of the treaty like everyone else. And so they had voluntarily suspended their work, but now they've announced they're going to resume that work. And as part of that, they informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that they were going to remove some seals and start some new work.
U.S. officials today denounced that move. We know that the president of Iran has been making some very hostile statements with regard to Israel of late, and there is the possibility that has been raised that if, in fact, enrichment goes forward, Israel or the United States might attack, as Israel did attack Iraq's reactor many years ago. Are you worried about that?
Well, I am worried about that, and I think there are two different things to keep in mind here. One are the statements by the Iranian President Ahmadinejad. They are, of course, ridiculous, horrific statements about the Holocaust not being true and that sort of thing. But it's important to remember that just as Khatami, President Khatami under Iran, was not the guy who was really in charge, this guy, who has no foreign policy experience and is not very educated, is not the guy in charge. The government is run not by the president, but by the supreme ruler and the expediency council. So this guy going off and saying strange things as much as they should be condemned doesn't mean that that's actually Iranian policy. But on the issue of preemption, of taking a military strike, I think the Israelis and the Americans have thought about it, talked about it, and probably planned for it. And I think, as they have in the past, they would ultimately be counterproductive. What's happening here is Iran is in a wave, a passionate wave of nationalism. And what happens when you attack a country that's going through a nationalist, prideful period is that makes them all the more determined to do the thing that you don't want them to do. So these mullahs are not going to be in charge forever. There's going to be a change in government. They're unpopular amongst most people. We can hope that when that change comes, the new government will have enough sense to wash its hands of the nuclear program, that it will be tainted by its association with the mullahs. But if Israel or the U.S. attacks Iran, it will become a point of national pride, and it doesn't matter who's in power. They're going to continue their nuclear program and perhaps nuclear weapons development.
We're talking with Jim Walsh of the Project on Managing the Atom at Harvard University. What about sanctions by the U.N. Security Council if, in fact, the United States could get the matter referred there by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency?
Well, if they are able to get a referral to the Security Council, of course, any of the members, permanent members on the Security Council could veto a resolution involving sanctions. And UN watchers are paying particular attention to what Russia and what China might do. Would they actually vote to sanction Iran? And there are people who doubt that. Now, of course, the Russians have made a proposal to resolve this crisis. The Iranians appear to be rejecting it, so that may leave the Russians a little more unhappy with the Iranians than they were before. But I think, you know, at a time when oil is expensive, and Iran's one of the major oil and natural gas producers and exporters, it's going to be tough to get sanctions that are the equivalent of what the U.S. alone has against Iran. I think much more likely is that if there is a referral to the Security Council will pass a resolution that gives the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, a broader and deeper mandate for continuing its investigation. So the result will not be punishment per se, but a more robust mandate allowing the agency to conduct more inspections and to collect more information about Iran's nuclear program.
All right, so the beat goes on. A provocative action today by Iran. We will see what reaction ensues. Jim Walsh, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Executive Director, Project on Managing the Atom at Harvard. In a moment, can Washington politics be reformed? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. The Washington firm, run by former aides to Republican Tom DeLay, has shut down its lobbying operation. Former DeLay aides who run the Alexander Strategy Group are described by the Washington Post today as the key gatekeepers for DeLay. The firm employed DeLay's wife for 4 years, and it's closely associated with Jack Abramoff, who's pleaded guilty to charges of corruption. Edwin Buckham, the former DeLay aide who owns the company, says reports in the press are what put him out of the lobbying business. Under indictment in Texas, DeLay himself has given up his post as majority leader in Congress. House Speaker Dennis Hastert has said he will move forward aggressively and quickly for lobbying reform. Larry Noble is executive director of the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks political money and its impact on public policy. Larry Noble, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
What appears to be the most likely kind of reform to be proposed by the Speaker?
My best guess now is the most likely reform will be disclosure, to increase lobbying disclosure, to increase the reporting of trips members take with lobbyists, and to get that out to the public much quicker. But obviously, that's only one part of the problem.
What's the other part of the problem, or the other parts of the problem?
Well, the other parts of the problem have to do with the culture that has arisen in Congress that really allows members to take trips sponsored by clients of lobbyists. that allow the fundraising that goes on, sponsored by lobbyists or put together by lobbyists. And there's this whole culture of perks that has developed that I think is really being exposed now by the Abramoff scandal, even though what Abramoff himself is accused of is something a little bit different, which is bribery.
Well, what about members of Congress who are extremely sensitive to all of this and who are actually challenging the current leadership?
Well, I think there are a number of members who are sensitive, and especially on the Republican side, they see this as a real problem in an election year. And you have those members who want to see some real change, but you also have a number of members, I think, who would like to see this blow over and think that disclosure may very well be a way to do something or look like they're doing something without actually upsetting the perks they can get. Because the reality is a number of members have become very used to living off these corporate perks, very used to the fundraising that lobbyists can do for them, very used to taking the private corporate jets and don't really want to give that up.
Again, we're talking with Larry Noble at the Center for Responsive Politics. We're hoping in a moment to have one of the major leaders of the reform effort in Congress, or I should say the person deputized by the Speaker to draw up his reforms, let me put it that way. We will hope to have Representative David Dreyer of California with us in just a moment. In the meantime, Larry Noble, back to you. How much has this situation, this culture, as you call it, changed over the past few years, and to what extent is it due to the leadership by the Republicans in the majority?
Well, I think, in all fairness, the Republicans, there have been these problems before. In fact, if you go back to 1994 when the Republicans took over, it was largely on a wave of corruption problems on the Democratic side. And the Republicans came to the House and said, took over in the House and said at that time that they would clean up the problems that the Democrats were having. So we go through these waves where members get into trouble, there are corruption problems, and then there are some reforms, and then things calm down for a while, and I think after being in power for a while, members start getting used to these various types of perks. I think one of the things that added to it this time is something that's called the K Street Project, and this was something that Tom DeLay and many Republicans are involved in, and people outside of Congress are involved in, and this was a project where the Republicans made it clear to K Street, and K Street in Washington is the street where the lobbyists are, where a lot of the lobbying firms are and a lot of the law firms are. And they made it clear to the lobbyists and to the trade associations in Washington that they were expecting, the Republicans were expecting a very close relationship. They were expecting political contributions. They were expecting the lobbyists and the trade association to hire Republicans and not to be supporting the Democratic Party. And I think this project, which has been going on for quite a while, and its success also gave rise to this culture where there was a very close relationship with lobbyists, and they really started to blur the lines between what is appropriate and what's not appropriate.
What do you mean by success in this context?
Well, they got a lot of the lobbying firms to hire Republicans. They weren't totally successful. In some instances, they tried to get trade associations to not hire Democrats, and in some cases, that did not succeed. The trade associations would hire the Democrat, but then would also hire a Republican to go along. But they were successful in steering a lot more money to Republicans. I think they were successful in making many lobbying firms that were used to dealing with both Republicans and Democrats a little bit more cautious. And I think that they were successful in letting it be known that the political contributions would really be the entree into the members' offices. And if you wanted something done, you would have to be seen as a supporter of the party.
Is that new?
It's not new. What was new was the bluntness of it, if you will, was the explicitness of it. There's always been this connection between political contributions and access. That's often why lobbyists give contributions, arrange fundraisers, have people in the industry make the contributions. And so that's always existed. What was new, I think, and what was really brought to a new level was the explicitness that of this connection between making contributions and gaining access.
Larry Noble, once again, Executive Director of the Center for Responsive Politics. As we hoped, we have been joined by Republican David Dreyer. He's the chair of the House Rules Committee, represents the 26th Congressional District in Los Angeles County, and he has been asked by Speaker Hastert to address this issue of what is alleged to be political corruption. corruption on Capitol Hill. Mr. Dreyer, as always, welcome to our program.
Well, nice to be back with you, Warren. I thought you'd forgotten about me. It's a long time since you've invited me to be on your program.
Can't forget about you. You're the chair of the Rules Committee. We've asked for you a couple of times.
Oh, and, yeah. So it's my fault, so you're now blaming me. Okay.
That's right. That's okay. Right. I'm in the press. I got to blame the members of Congress.
Well, finally, something honest said from the Fourth Estate.
A moment ago, we heard from Larry Noble that the most likely reform to be offered by the Speaker is disclosure. He says that the members have gotten used to perks like trips and fundraisers. They're not going to be likely to get rid of those, and that they think that perhaps they can get past this, let it blow over, by simply proposing disclosure. What do you say to that?
Well, my response is that anyone who knows exactly what the package is going to consist of should tell me, because I'm in the process of getting input from a wide range of members, Democrats and Republicans, people outside of the Capitol, and we are going to focus, because I've said it, on disclosure and transparency, because I believe one of the most important things that we can do is to empower the American people with more information as to who is supporting whom and what activity takes place. But we clearly are looking at a wide range of other options there that would go further than that. I've just had a very good conversation with my colleague John McCain, with whom I am going to be working closely with this. I spoke earlier today. I'm going to be meeting tomorrow with Congressman Steny Hoyer, who is the second-ranking Democrat, the minority whip on this issue, and I've talked to other Democrats as well, and Republicans. We had a conference call last night of all the Republican members, and there is a great desire to make some bold changes. And the Speaker of the House has tasked me with doing just that, and that's what we plan to do. So, you know, it's interesting to have all kinds of speculation as if this is a fait accompli, and that is just plain wrong.
The Washington Post and ABC did a poll in which 90% of the people who responded said that gifts to congresspeople, trips by lobbyists should be banned. Is there a chance for that?
Of course there's a chance for that. That's one of the things that is under discussion. I can't tell you with certainty that that's what's going to happen, but I certainly can tell you that it's something that is going to be considered. But again, if you think about it, the ability for people to participate and petition their government is an important thing. One of the other things that we're talking about is the issue of higher standards for people who do have the opportunity to become registered lobbyists here. So there are any number of things that we are considering, and I'm open to that. Frankly, I would say to your audience, if there are recommendations that they have that they'd like to get to us, to contact us here in the Capitol, we are listening to people all across the country as we seek to try and ensure the integrity of the greatest deliberative body known to man, the United States Congress.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking with David Dreyer. He's Republican chair of the House Rules Committee. He's a congressman from California, and he's eager to hear your views. That same poll that I mentioned shows that two-thirds of those who were surveyed said they would like to see a ban on campaign contributions by lobbyists. What are the chances of that?
Well, that's another thing that is actually under discussion. I spoke with someone earlier today about the possibility of doing that. Now, I think that the natural question that comes up is a constitutional question. I mean, can you ban an individual from being able to voluntarily express themselves through a contribution, which is speech? As you know, Warren, the Supreme Court has equated money with the freedom of speech. So I think that there is a constitutional question there, but that is something that that we have discussed, and I think it's something that will be considered.
When you say it's important for people to participate in government and at the same time money is considered by the U.S. Supreme Court to be speech, what do you say to people who say, I don't have any money, therefore I don't get the speech?
But guess what? I mean, I will tell you, if you want to come back, Warren, and sit in my outer office and answer the phone, I will give you the opportunity to hear from plenty of people who may or may not have money, but they certainly voice their opinions to me on a regular basis. So.
But do they get policy made by doing that in the way that a lobbyist does who contributes to
a campaign? The short answer to that question is yes, they do. I mean, I'll never forget in one of my early terms in the Congress, somebody had I found out later they'd had a bet with someone on an idea that dealt with, frankly, the Soviet Union, and it was a constituent who came forward with an idea on the development of a hotline between Moscow and Washington. And it was an idea that came forward from someone who, as far as I know, may or may not contribute. I don't know if they had two nickels to rub together, but it was an idea, and we were able to pass it as legislation. So
I think that this view that, you know, unless you make a campaign contribution, you cannot have any influence on public policy is a very cynical one, and it is an inaccurate one.
What about the practice of lobbyists who hire the wives of sitting members of Congress? Today, the Washington Post is reporting that the Alexander Strategy Group, which is run by some of Congressman DeLay's former aides, in fact employed his wife as well as the wife of Congressman Doolittle, another congressman from California. Is that something that you think you could ban if you wanted to?
I think that, you know, again, that's something that will be looked at and addressed, and I know it's something that obviously has come to our attention. I was not aware of it. But have found out about it in the last several months.
What about what was called the K Street Project? We heard it described a little earlier by Larry Noble, again, of the Center for Responsive Politics. Was that an appropriate way for the Republican leadership to operate? And were you yourself, as part of the leadership, chair of the Rules Committee, involved with the K Street Project?
No, I wasn't involved in that myself. I will tell you that the process of encouraging people to let me just say, for four decades, there was uninterrupted one-party control of the United States House of Representatives. And there was a sense that everyone in this town who was involved in the process were members of one political party, and it wasn't the Republican Party. And so the goal was to try and bring some bipartisanship back to the lobbying community. I mean, I think that was really the goal, because, I mean, and I would guess right now that if you look at the lobbying corridor known as K Street, that there probably is reasonable balance between Democrats and Republicans. And I think that was in large part the goal of the K Street Project, although I was not involved in that myself at all.
There are those who argue, and there was a long piece recently in the New York Times to this effect, that when government grows as big as it does, when regulation is as pervasive as it is, there's going to be lobbying and that it's going to end up being corrupt simply because there is so much at stake. Is that too cynical a view? Is it possible to keep this out of this kind of corruption that we've seen of late, to the Jack Abramoff story, out of politics?
Well, Warren, let me say that, you know, as a Republican, my first goal would be to achieve the test of addressing the first thing that you used as a basis from which you posed the question, and that is, I'd like to reduce the size and scope of government. And I agree with you. One of the reasons that we see this proliferation.
I didn't say that was my idea. I just said other people.
But that was the basis of your question, and I will tell you that that what I'm arguing is that I think that if we were to reduce the size and scope of government, which is a constant goal that I have, the reach of government. I'm a small L libertarian Republican. I want less government, and I think that the bigger it is, the greater the potential for the problem. And so I do think that that is something that we should continue to strive towards. And what was the second part of your question?
That government has gotten so big that you can't restore credibility to it and ethics to it. And as I asked that, we've just got a few seconds left. I also want to know how long it's going to take you to make your proposals.
Well, we're going to be doing it in the next several weeks. As you know, our goal is to ensure the integrity of this institution, which is very important. It's very important for the American people. They understand that this is something that has hit both political parties. It's not impacted one party, contrary to what some are trying to claim. And yes, I want to do it in the next few weeks. The president is delivering a State of the Union message on January 31st, that Tuesday night. And it's my hope that in the weeks after that, we'll be able to implement legislation and possibly see the speaker take some action himself.
So you don't hope that this is just going to blow over. There will be, you're pledging now, there are going to be some changes.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that we're going to see some changes. I mean, I'm determined to make that happen, Warren.
David Dreyer, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Chair of the House Rules Committee, appointed by the Speaker to come up with reforms for the lobbying scandals that we have seen of late. We will be back. Talk more with Larry Noble and other guests in just a moment. On Reporter's Notebook, FEMA says Katrina victims in New Orleans hotels are in for some hard choices before Mardi Gras. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're not only back with To the Point. We have just heard from David Dreyer, chair of the House Rules Committee, appointed by the Speaker, Dennis Hastert, to try to deal with the corruption scandals that have been pervasive so recently on Capitol Hill. A moment ago, we heard from Larry Noble at the Center for Responsive Politics. We'll get back to him in a moment. First, I want to go to Mika Sifri, who's a senior analyst with Public Campaign. That's a nonprofit based in Washington, works on comprehensive campaign reform, also has a blog at Mika.Sifri, S-I-F-R-Y.com. Mika, good to have you back with us.
Always good to be here, Warren.
A moment ago, David Dreyer said that the emphasis is on disclosure and transparency, but there is consideration of a ban on gifts and trips, on a ban on campaign contributions by lobbyists, bans on having their wives and relatives of members work for lobbyists. What do you think are the prospects for getting those measures passed?
Well, let me say, Warren, have you wiped off your glasses of all the fog that was just blown at you? You know, I was amused listening to Representative Dreyer as he talked to you, and I commend him for coming on the show. But, you know, it's fascinating to watch the Republicans now claim that they're going to clean up this mess. I have right in front of me, in talking about disclosure, a copy of a letter that Representative Dreyer sent to a constituent of his back in December of 2004 when the Republicans were riding high, explaining why he had voted in a meeting of the Republican caucus to maintain a rule that would have protected Tom DeLay from having to step down from his post as majority leader in the event that he was indicted. David Dreyer is part of the problem. It's hard to see how he's going to be part of the solution now. Nevertheless, the poll that you cited, the one that shows that the public, once again, is way ahead of the politicians in terms of understanding how bad the problem is, and the fact that 90% of the public wants to see an outright ban on gifts from lobbyists, on travel paid for by lobbyists. I mean, this ought to be a no-brainer for Congress. If they need to go to Scotland do some official business, let it be paid for by the taxpayer, not by Jack Abramoff or some other interest groups that he's representing. Nobody forces these guys to go on these trips, and the problem is to expect the very same ones who have been reveling in this, you and I last saw each other at the Republican convention, if I don't recall correctly, and I remember thinking, gee, I wish I could have gotten into David Dreyer's Apple Martini's bowling party downtown. That was just one of dozens and dozens of special events that the Republicans were throwing for all the most powerful and wealthy interests in the country. The thing is, this all goes on openly, and the public is just sick and tired of it.
All right. Mika Sifri, once again, senior analyst with Public Campaign. Let me just say that Congressman Dreyer declined to have an exchange with the other guests on this program. And frankly, I didn't know about that letter he sent in 2004. I wish I could have asked him about it. Jan Barron is former general counsel of the Republican National Committee, served on the President's Commission on Federal Ethics Reform, not a lobbyist himself, although he does advise clients on campaign finance and lobbying laws. He himself is a lawyer. Jan Barron, good to have you back on our program.
Hello, Warren. Nice to be here.
Was David Dreyer blowing smoke? Was he, in fact, a part of the problem?
Well, I've been in Washington for 30 years, and I do try to be realistic about predictions, but I have to give David Dreyer the benefit of the doubt, not only because I know him and I know that he is a man of his word, but I think that the current situation demands substantive action from Congress on these issues.
Does that mean more than just disclosure?
Well, I think it absolutely will be and has to be more, and if it's not, it's going to be a problem for these people. They have to address, as I indicated in an article in last Sunday's Washington Post, these issues like gifts. It's not an accident that 90% of the public doesn't want politicians accepting gifts, whether they're from lobbyists or anybody else for that matter. They're going to have to address the privately funded travel. I think that there's got to be more restrictions. There's no way that the public is going to accept the proposition that a congressman or a senator can travel to Europe at the expense of some private interests in virtually unlimited amounts for first class airfare and the best hotels and all this other stuff. It's just unacceptable. And it may not be true that everyone behaves the way Jack Abramoff does. In fact, I personally don't know anyone who's behaved the way he does. But there's clearly too much private underwriting of social activity of these elected officials, and it's unacceptable and unhealthy. And if they don't fix it, they're not going to restore any trust or confidence from the American public.
John Barron, former counsel of the Republican National Committee, back to Mika Cifre of Public Campaign. When I asked Congressman Dreyer about the constitutional decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that there's an equation between money and speech, when I asked him about campaign contributions, that was what he raised in response. As long as that's the case, what can you do about the money in politics? Could you, in fact, bar lobbyists from contributing to campaigns?
No, you couldn't do that. And I have to say, nor do you necessarily want to do that. I mean, I think it's true that lobbying is a form of free speech, and we should all have the ability to petition our government and our representatives. The question is when the argument isn't being made on the merits, but it's being made because a $2,000 campaign contribution is what got you in the door in the first place. Most Americans can't afford to make those kind of contributions, and absolutely understand that the process has been completely skewed away from what a real democracy would be. The best thing that you can do is we can move towards a system of full public financing for campaigns that would at least give public representatives who voluntarily choose to not take any private contributions to get full public funding, to have enough money to run a viable race. We already have this system in place in a number of states, including Arizona, Maine, Connecticut, just passed it last month in response to a gigantic pay-for-play scandal that took down the state's Republican governor as well as a number of other top officials. The point here is to break the dependence that elected officials have on private interests to finance their campaigns. And, unfortunately today it costs a lot of money to run for office. And where are you going to get that money? If you're not already rich and you don't have a lot of rich friends, inevitably you go to where that money is concentrated, and lobbyists are just the hired hands for that money. And what we need to do is move towards the sorts of systems, we call it clean money, clean elections, that we have in places like Arizona, Connecticut, and Maine.
Mika Cifre with Public Campaign. Back to Jon Barron, formerly with the Republican National Committee. What about that? If we already have it in other states, if it's voluntary for candidates, wouldn't a system like that pressure them, make it almost impossible for them to accept private contributions?
Well, we've had a public funding system for presidential elections since 1976, and there are some real practical problems implementing it, even continuing it for the presidential system, let alone expanding it for the House and Senate races.
What are those problems?
Well, one of them is money. The amount of money that's necessary to use taxpayer dollars to fund these campaigns would be substantial. The second problem is that public financing is not going to be able to be 100% publicly financed. In fact, the presidential elections permit private funding in part. They have a matching system in the primaries, and then full public funding in the general election.
Why not ban it altogether?
On
a voluntary basis.
If American taxpayers want to have essentially $1 billion of their tax money spent on campaigns, that is certainly possible. There's not been a groundswell that I've noticed in any polling or in any letters to the Hill for that type of a system. And the third thing is that there's going to be, notwithstanding whatever public funding system you have, whatever spending limits you impose as part of those systems, still a lot of other money, particularly so-called issue ads and independent spending, that will surround these types of elections. It is, frankly, easier to implement it on a state level. State legislative races are smaller, less expensive, and there are states that have made commitments to try that out. They tend to be relatively small states. And if they are successful, if they can persuade taxpayers in other states to expand it and perhaps grow it at the federal level, that's certainly a possibility, but I don't see that as anywhere near imminent.
John Barron, formerly with the Republican National Committee. Let me go back to Larry Noble, our earlier guest with the Center for Responsive Politics, and let me ask you a couple of things. First, in response to what David Dreyer said, you indicated at the outset that you thought disclosure, once again, was going to be the principal focus. He said that it was, but also that these other broader measures are being considered, at least, bans on gifts and trips and so on. Do you think, based on what he said, that it might be that they're talking themselves into stronger measures than you anticipated?
It's possible, and I think, you know, it's good to hear that he said they are thinking about bold changes. But he did say that the focus would be on disclosure. Now, Jan might be right that they might really have hit a point where they do think that they have to do more than just disclosure to really get back public confidence. I'm still somewhat skeptical. I'm not going to take bets one way or the other on it, but I'm still somewhat skeptical. One thing I haven't heard, and I didn't hear him talk about, was enforcement. And I think one of the problems that they've had in the House is they've had a dormant or dead ethics committee that just doesn't do anything. They've had in the House of Representatives for quite a while an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats not to file ethics complaints against each other. They don't allow outside groups to file ethics complaints. And so one thing they really need to do something about is enforcement, because whatever rules they put into effect are not going to matter if there's no one around to enforce those rules. And I did not hear him talk about that at all.
Mika Sifri, back to you with Public Campaign. Do you think that stronger enforcement, stronger measures of the sort that we have been talking about, would increase the public acceptance of public financing on a broader basis, or make it more difficult if it appeared that Congress was reforming itself?
Well, you know, I think this is a longer historic trend that you know, people, as we see how much it costs us to have a system where wealthy private interests basically turn the Treasury into their piggy bank. People, I think, are beginning to see that, you know, we have to spend a little bit more money to protect the integrity of our electoral system. So that's one change that I think would happen regardless. If we got more disclosure, by the way, and I think more disclosure would be a good thing, I think it would be, you know, I mean, it's ludicrous that, for example, they don't post the text of bills, you know, a couple of days before they vote on them. Sometimes they vote on these things without even having read them. It's crazy that we can't get more timely disclosure from lobbyists of when, of the reports that they're supposed to file. They're only once every 6 months. Why can't they be, you know, once a week? This is the internet age, isn't it? So there are lots of things that could be done. Personally, what I'd like to see is greater involvement in the public, on the part of the public, in helping be a check on what every member does. And the best way to do that is by bringing more sunlight in, bringing, as Justice Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. If we were able to see, you know, if every member of Congress, when they earmark, particular provisions in a bill that are designed to benefit a particular constituent or a contributor, they ought to be required to say who they're doing it on behalf of. The same thing when they intervene with a regulatory agency. If what they're doing is benign, then what's the problem with letting us know? I mean, it's only because they want to hide this stuff that public distrust grows.
Okay. Let me go back to Jan Barron with the Republican National Committee. David Dreyer said at the end of the interview a moment ago that if the size of government were reduced, then the possibilities for corruption would be reduced as well. Is that a good argument?
Well, I think that if government was smaller, had less of a role in our society, we would definitely have fewer lobbyists. I think the percentage of rotten lobbyists will probably remain the same, just as the percentage of crooked public officials may still stay the same. What I think his point is, and it's a valid one that was made in a column today by columnist George Will, which is that if government becomes a place that makes constant, massive decisions in our society and becomes a source of what George Will refers to as rent-seeking, which means that people go to the government because they want what they consider to be their fair share of the pot for their projects, for their industries, for their causes, then we're going to have lots of lobbying, lots of lobbyists, and we're going to have these people here in town intersecting with government officials.
All right. Again, Jan Barron is formerly with the Republican National Committee. Amika Sifri, quickly, if you will, senior analyst with Public Campaign, what do you say to that argument?
Well, you know, people like George Will, and in fact most Republicans, would like to shrink governments down to the size that they can drown it in the bathtub, as Grover Norquist famously said. I think it's a spurious argument. I think what we're hearing is a lot of complaints. This is all part of the business backlash that started in the 1970s against a lot of good things that government was trying to do on behalf of everyone, such as protect the air and the water, improve worker safety, and so on and so forth. That this is, they would like to somehow cram the ethics scandals that we're seeing across Congress into their old agenda of shrinking government, and I think it just doesn't fly.
All right. A lot of issues to be discussed today. Larry Noble, quickly back to you at the Center for Responsive Politics. Why can't the members of Congress just make the laws by themselves? Why do they need lobbyists?
Well, lobbyists do serve a valid purpose. You know, lobbyists are a way that members of the public can have a representation in Congress. What lobbyists can do is take a lot of different voices together and present issues to Congress, to members of Congress, explain complicated issues, explain what various sectors want. So I'm in agreement with those who say lobbying isn't the problem. The problem is the way lobbying is done, the tools lobbyists use, and the culture that members of Congress have created that allow lobbyists to get in the door by wielding such things as private trips, rides in corporate jets, campaign financing, that type of thing. Well, lobbyists themselves are really representatives, and what they do is they explain the needs of the people that they are representing.
All right. Obviously, this is going to be an issue in Washington for a long time to come. David Dreyer said his proposals on behalf of Speaker Hastert will be ready after the State of the Union speech, which will be on the 31st, I believe, of this month. In any case, we will follow the story. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Come back again. Larry Noble, Center for Responsive Politics, Amika Sifri with Public Campaign, Jan Barron, formerly with the Republican National Committee and the President's Commission on Federal Ethics Law Reform, and our earlier guest, Republican David Dreyer of the House Rules Committee, in charge of reform for Speaker Hastert. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has spent $400 million for Hurricane Katrina victims to stay in hotels, many of them in New Orleans. But FEMA has announced they're in for what it calls some hard choices. It's almost time for Mardi Gras. We'll hear the latest on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manoni, back with Bob Porter's notebook on To the Point. Katrina evacuees in New Orleans hotels will have to get out by early next month, and they may have to go to other metropolitan areas or leave the state altogether. That's from James McIntyre of FEMA in an announcement yesterday that did not go well with Tracy Washington. She is a lawyer representing some of the Katrina evacuees in New Orleans. And Ms. Washington, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What's your objection to this after all of the time and all of the money that has been spent to keep people in hotels in New Orleans?
Well, the problem is that no alternatives have been provided for these individuals, viable alternatives for them to move. The the announcement did not state that FEMA was necessarily going to provide housing for these individuals in New Orleans. The problem is the hotels are under no obligation to continue to house these people, notwithstanding the fact that some of them are making up to $200 per night per room. These hotels have reaped the benefits, you know, of this FEMA program for months now, when there would have been no tourism and no one staying in the hotels. I've seen bills from hotels upwards of $3,000 and $4,000 a month per room. And FEMA was supposed to have provided apartments and trailers for these individuals. Folks have been, you know, playing politics on the theme, on the trailer issue here in New Orleans. People don't want trailers in their backyards. People who live around Audubon Park don't want the trailers there. They don't want them, you know, they consider them to be eyesores. So folks who have jobs, families, folks who have kids in schools who cannot get back into their homes are left with, you know, no alternative.
So there's a lot of NIMBYism, obviously, in New Orleans. What is FEMA to do?
You know, FEMA is to take charge. I mean, ultimately, the answer to NIMBYism is leadership. When you put your foot on the ground and you say, enough already. We don't care that you don't want it in your backyard. We're not going to continue to pay this money. And we're not going to have a group of homeless people out here. And that's what I'm faced with every day and why we've had to file lawsuits. I'm sitting in front of a hotel right now where I have a woman with three kids, all under the age of three, who are being kicked out, evicted out of a hotel tomorrow. And the hotel owner told them, you can come back on the 18th or the 19th, but we've got a convention coming into town. Well, that's not acceptable.
What about the effort by the city to encourage business, to get people to come back, to have tourism, to stage Mardi Gras, in order to establish the city of New Orleans, again, as a financially viable institution?
It is a fundamental lack of leadership and planning on the part of the city and the state to have folks come back to New Orleans, where our mayor literally went around the country to Atlanta, to Houston, to Shreveport, to Los Angeles, and begged folks to return to New Orleans. Folks did return. I just spoke to a woman who said she was in Atlanta. And when he said, come home, help rebuild the city, she came home. And now she has no place to stay. We will have a homeless population in this city beginning at the end of this month that will be unrivaled by any other city, because we have folks who don't want trailers in their backyard, because the mayor has not planned for apartments, and because he's decided that Mardi Gras is far more important than housing individuals who are Katrina victims and survivors.
Talking with Tracy Washington, labor, employment, and civil rights attorney in New Orleans. Tell us a little bit more about the family with the three children that you said is about to be kicked out of the hotel where you're standing right now. What kind of appeal are you making to the hotel, and are you able, under those circumstances, to go to court? Do you think you can get action in time?
On Saturday, this past Saturday, we found a judge, and we got a court order against one of the hotels in the city that had evicted folks. It was cold outside. There were folks with children standing on the St. Charles Avenue streetcar line with their children and watching as the hotel was throwing out their mattresses and furniture and everything else. We were able to get a court to order that the hotel was enjoined from evicting these individuals. These hotels have served as landlords, and these folks have received sometimes one-day notice, less than one-day notice, that they had to be out of the rooms. The judge said there's no self-help eviction here in the state of Louisiana. You have to give folks notice and sometime, if at all possible, to find adequate housing, you know, substitute housing. Since that time and since the publicity surrounding that, many of the hotels have rescinded the eviction actions and have allowed hurricane survivors to remain in the hotels. Yesterday, we were able to reach agreement with the Decatur Hotel chain, and individuals who were to be evicted yesterday have been allowed to stay through January 27th. But unfortunately, it's a hotel-by-hotel situation, and what I'm hoping is that tomorrow, in a separate legal action brought by the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, they can convince the federal judge that we cannot do this on a piecemeal basis. Under federal law, FEMA has an obligation to not wash their hands of these survivors, but to ensure that there is adequate housing for them.
It's my understanding that in at least one case, there was a claim by a hotel owner that the people involved in or living in one of the rooms, or perhaps even more, were involved with illegal substances and engaged in illegal behavior. How much of that has there been, and is there any argument on behalf of the hotels based on the way that people have behaved since they've been living there?
Well, look, I would never tell a hotel owner that you have to keep tenants in your hotel or in your apartment that are, you know, using illegal drugs or engaging in illegal activity. But the first time I asked them what illegal activity was going on, their first response was, we have individuals cooking on hot plates in the room. I told them that's not illegal. That may be against hotel policy, but it's not illegal. You know, they backed off that assertion. I understand one tenant was asked not to return, but everybody else was allowed to return to their room. And, you know, I'm not representing these folks on an individual basis, but I'm trying desperately to buy some time until FEMA, our governor, and our mayor can sit down and come up with a solution concerning adequate housing. You cannot simply tell folks who have children in school and who have jobs here now, you know what, there's not any space for you in the city of New Orleans. We've got space in Oregon. That's not what the law requires of them.
What do you think is the number of people who might be forced out of the hotels if your court action is not successful?
There are 62 hotels in the city of New Orleans that are under contract with FEMA through Corporate Lodging Corporation to house Katrina and Rita survivors. I don't know how many rooms that represents, but in the Decatur hotel chain, that was 1,800 rooms. 1,800 rooms that had been rented out at various hotels for the last 3 to 4 months. And they recognize that it is in their best interest to have all of their hotel rooms occupied. I understand Mardi Gras is coming up, and I understand some of the hotels in between a rock and a hard place, but I think the American public, if they understood, look, if we come down here for Mardi Gras, we may be making a family homeless. We have homes in New York and in California and in Oregon. We don't have to come to Mardi Gras. We'll allow these people to stay in these hotel rooms. The individual, people in the country will make that choice, that's the choice that has to be made.
A lot of issues to be dealt with, an ongoing struggle in New Orleans and other parts of Louisiana and Mississippi as well, of course. Tracy Washington, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Labor, employment, civil rights attorney in New Orleans, representing some of the evacuees in the hotels in that city. Today's program produced by Jonah King with Katie Cooper, Cameron Radziner, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.